We believe we have a mandate to bring godly change to our nation and the world through the seven spheres or mountains of influence. Welcome to the Truth and Liberty broadcast, brought to you by 7M Ventures and Andrew Womack Ministries.
Hello and welcome to our Monday night Truth and Liberty livecast. I'm Andrew Womack. I've got Richard Harris here with us, and you are our counsel.
General counsel.
General counsel. He is a practicing lawyer, and we've been talking about what his title should be, so I think we're going to call him the general counsel. Those of you who watch on a regular basis, we usually have Karen Conrad with us, but she is getting married in just, what, 1 week or?
Two weeks maximum.
She's not with us tonight, but hopefully we can get through without her. It'll be good. And our special guest tonight is Jay Sekulow. And I tell you, this is an honor to have him with us. He is the chief counsel for the ACLJ, and God has promoted him to a special position, and we're going to have a great time with him. So right before we get into that, let me go through just a few things that we want to talk about, and then we will kick it back to Jay Sekulow, and we're going to have a great time talking to him. But first of all, let me mention that we have a giveaway, and you can enter that by signing up. If you are watching on our website, and we would like to encourage you to go to the truthandliberty.net website, because they have been censoring us. Anytime we talk about anything controversial on Facebook, they will kick us off. So if you want to get the whole thing, and I think Jay is going to probably have some things that might be censored. I know I get censored often. Go to truthandliberty.net, and if you will sign up, we are giving away my book on Don't Limit God. Last week's winner was Mark Laughlin, and he got The Army of God Rising, and that's by Pastor Mark Cowart. Mark Cowart is the one who directs our practical government school, and he's a tremendous blessing. So anyway, we encourage you to participate in that. Also, we need to mention just a few things. We got James Brown and Tony Dungy are going to be with us next week, March the 14th through the 16th. They're also speaking in our local school and a major school down in Colorado Springs. And I tell you, these men just love God. We've had them for the last 2 years. It's going to be a powerful time. That's March the 14th through the 16th, our men's advance. We've got our Army conference coming up in Woodland Park on March the 26th through the 28th. And we're going to have Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin with us. Former Congressman Bill McEwen is going to be with us. And it's going to be a great time. This is primarily for ministers or people that are involved in church or ministry things. We've also got our Caris Bible College Campus Days coming up, and that's on April the 3rd through the 5th. We have our King of Jerusalem musical coming up. We've also got John Tesh is going to be with us. I'm going through these quickly, but if you'll go to our website, we will have information about this. And I tell you, John and Connie Tesh, they've just become great friends, and these people, God is using them, and he's going to be doing a free concert right here on April the 25th. And then we have our Kingdom Business Summit coming up June the 12th through the 14th. We also have people available right now on our phones. We've got, I don't know, dozens of people over there. If you call 719-635-1111, you can talk to somebody. They will answer your questions. If we mention something, about one of our books or materials or anything, we have people there that have all of that information, and they'll be glad to give that to you. So anyway, there's probably more that could be said. One last thing is that after we talk to Jay for maybe 30 minutes or a little bit more, we are going to open it up for questions. And if you're on the Truth and Liberty website, there's a place right there that you can send in your questions. And I'm really not computer literate enough to tell you how to do it on any of the other things. But hopefully you know what to do. And we would love to take your questions, and Jay will be interacting with us.
That's right.
So, Jay, I see you on the video monitor. Are you with us now?
I am. Thanks for having me.
Well, wonderful. Man, this is an honor to have you with us. You know, my wife and I have been partners with the ACLJ for many years.
Yep, almost since the beginning.
We are just really thrilled at the way that God has promoted you. We've seen you rise from, I think it was, what, back in the 90s is when you began this?
Late 80s, actually. Officially in 91, but we started doing some of this in the late 80s. So it's been a long time, but you're right. It's certainly in a different place than I think anybody would have anticipated even a half dozen years ago, or maybe even 2.5 years ago.
And now you're international, and you're taking on cases way beyond the reach of America. So it's just tremendous to see how God's promoted you. And just recently, you become President Trump's lawyer. So, man.
Right. That's 2 years.
What an influence. That is tremendous. You know, we want to talk about some of the current events, but let me just, first of all, I know that you don't usually get into, like, your personal testimony or something like that, but could you just quickly give us some background about your relationship with the Lord and how God led you into doing what you're doing?
So, I mean, here you go. You know, I actually love being able to share my testimony. I don't get to do it as much as I'd like. But so I was born in Brooklyn, New York. I grew up in New York till I was a teenager, moved to Atlanta when I was about 16 years old, and went to college pretty young, almost barely 18. And it was in the early 70s, and it was during the Jesus movement. Mm-hmm. And I'm this Jewish kid from Brooklyn, and I'm hearing the gospel in among classmates and from professors. And one of my professors named Bill Guerin, he's now with the Lord, but a great guy. He had to take a course in Old Testament or New Testament, Andrew. It was required. So I decided to take a course in New Testament because I had never read the New Testament. It was kind of the forbidden book for the Jewish community, as you can imagine. Yeah. And I decided I would read it, you know, take this course. So he did this section in the course where you took an Old Testament prophecy and you had to look at a New Testament fulfillment of that prophecy. And he assigned me as the 53rd chapter of Isaiah, which is the suffering servant.
Yes.
So who would believe our report, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? And bruised for our iniquities, chastised for us. I mean, it lays out the case for the Messiah. So I hear this, and it's kind of, And I look at the New Testament issues, and I kind of take out a yellow legal pad. In those days, you still use them, and kind of made the pros and cons, and kind of had this intellectual assent that, you know, Jesus might be the Messiah. But it kind of left it with that. And then this friend of mine who later became my wife said, I want you to go with me to a church presentation from a group called Jews for Jesus, which for me was like vegetarians for meat. I mean, you know, Jews for Jesus was, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
But I went, and you know, this is how the Holy Spirit works. I have to tell you this, Andrew, you know it as well as anybody in this country, around the world. I'm sitting in that church with no intent to do anything. And Stuart Dowerman, who's a friend of mine to this day, was in charge of the music group. It was called the Liberated Wailing Wall, and they did Jewish-style music and then gave testimonies, much like you're asking me to do right now. And he gave an invitation at the end of the presentation. If you want to come down and accept Jesus as your Messiah, come on down and talk to me. So, I mean, I walked right down. I mean, there I went. And like I said, I didn't walk into the church intending to do that. And I went down and came to Christ right there. And I'll never forget, I had a woman came up to me and said, Jewish woman, and said, listen, I was still living at home at the time. I was in freshman in college. And she said, if you get kicked out of your house, you could always stay with us. And I'm saying, kicked out of my house? Well, what are you talking about? So my friend Pam, who has now been my wife for 40 years, we went to a Wendy's right down the street from the church service. It was at a little Christian Missionary Alliance church in Decatur, Georgia, outside of Atlanta. And we talked about it. I said, oh, maybe I won't say anything to my parents tonight. So I come into the house at about 11:30 at night, almost midnight, on a Wednesday night. And I go past my parents' bedroom, and my father goes, where have you been? And I just said, well, I was just out with Pam, and I just kind of left it at that. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, I had this kind of guilt complex, I guess you would call it, where I felt like, you know, I kind of didn't tell him the truth. So I said, I came to my father's house, my parents' bedroom at about 2 o'clock in the morning, told my dad I needed to speak to him. And he said, at 2 o'clock in the morning, I said, yes, sir. So whatever he was thinking I was going to tell him at 18 years old, actually was not as bad as what I was about to tell him, whatever he was expecting. So I went down to the family meeting room, which is our kitchen. And I turned to my father, and we were sitting across the kitchen table. And I will never forget these words. I said, Dad, I have decided Jesus is the Messiah.
Wow.
And my father turned to me and said, you've decided that Jesus is the Messiah? Like, you get to make that decision? So I kind of said it inartfully, and he kind of, you know, you're like, you decided this is the case?
Yeah.
And he said, we'll talk about it in the morning. It was about 5 years in the morning. We really did not talk about it much. Ultimately, my very first case at the Supreme Court was Board of Airport Commissioners versus Jews for Jesus. Mm. And there I was before the Supreme Court of the United States. And as I got ready to make my argument, I turned to the back, and there was my parents. And my mother was, I mean, if you wanted to cast a Jewish woman for central casting from Brooklyn, my mother would have been that cast member. And she was about 5 feet tall with heels. I mean, she was not tall. And she wore this huge Statue of Liberty pin. I mean, the pin must have been 4 feet tall. Very proud. And I'm the grandson of Russian immigrants. My grandparents came to the United States in 1914. And their grandson, me, I get to argue cases at the Supreme Court around the world and represent a president. Mm. So, I mean, God's in control. Like I said, I walked in that church never expecting. And I can honestly say life has never been the same since that moment. Okay. And that's part of walking by faith. You just kind of, you know, you walk by faith, and that's what you just see what doors the Lord opens. And I think, you know, I pinch myself often. Not going to say it's not a lot of pressure these days, as you can imagine. But my wife Pam said, you know, if somebody comes up to you and says, I can't imagine what it's like, you say, you're right, you can't. It's fair to say that now. Yeah. But actually, God's been really great. And I appreciate you asking me about my testimony. By the way, my mother ultimately came to the Lord as well. And actually led her oncologist, who was a Jewish family in Atlanta, was the head of the synagogue we went to, who also came, his entire family came to faith.
Praise
so, you, Andrew, I'm not
Praise
telling you anything
God.
You don't know. You know how faith works. And that's exactly what I've seen in my own life and with my own family. And there you have it. But,
man, that's awesome.
So
you know, fantastic.
I'm the Jew for Jesus. Right.
I've been following you for many decades, but, you know, to hear that testimony, that's the first time I'd ever heard that. That was just awesome.
That is awesome.
That's great.
That was great. Thank you.
All right. So real briefly, for anybody who doesn't know what the ACLJ is, would you give just a brief explanation, maybe the scope of what you're doing, things like that?
So the American Center for Law and Justice started in the early 1990s, actually 1990. I had started doing work. I had that Jews for Jesus case in 1987, then had a Bible Club case in 1990, and then Pat Robertson and Paul Crouch and others had this idea. And it was really Pat envisioned this institutional organization that would be a counterweight to the ACLU, and came up with, it was Pat's name, came up with the name American Center for Law and Justice. So we launched in 1990. In 1997, we increased our offices around the globe. We opened up an office in Moscow. We opened up an office in Strasbourg, France, which is where the European Union and the European Court of Human Rights all meets. And we now have an office in Jerusalem. We have offices in Africa and the continent, in Zimbabwe. We've done work literally around the globe. So over about a 10-year period, we became very much an international organization. We do a lot, of course, domestic work on religious liberty, but also, I mean, we just were defending some churches the other day that were being denied the access to build in certain communities. We handled those cases. You don't hear about those anymore like you used to, but we had lawyers out in South Carolina. We had lawyers out in San Francisco. I mean, we dispatched lawyers. We had an additional team in Washington representing a Christian pastor who's in jail in China, Pastor John Saul, who were praying for his release and working very aggressively for his release in China. We had the great news with Pastor Andrew Brunson out of Turkey, got hit. The Lord provided his release. At the same week, Asiya Bibi in Pakistan was acquitted of the charges of blasphemy. So God just continued to open up doors for us. So in a very real way, and you've been such a big part of our ministry, which I can't tell you how much we appreciate. Have opened up. We've gone through the doors the Lord's opened. We opened up our office in Jerusalem. I ended up representing Israel's interests before the International Criminal Court in The Hague. So it's just been a tremendous. What God has done is just I can't even describe it. I mean, it's so much beyond where we thought we would be, and that's why it's not in the natural. I mean, you always have to understand what God is doing. I could not have orchestrated the events that led to any of this, Andrew. Can I share one quick story?
Sure.
I know we got
pressed
on time, but this is one I know you'll appreciate. We started out with a small organization out of Atlanta, Georgia. And it was basically me and my wife, and that was it. We eventually had one other lawyer helping me. We shared an office. I mean, literally, he and I shared an office. And I fly out to California on a case for Jews for Jesus. And I sit next to a guy who has a program on the Trinity Broadcasting Network. And we're talking in the airport airplane, and he invites me on. And I go on air to a network that I didn't know much about because TBN had not yet been that big on the East Coast, very large in the Midwest, large in the West, and of course in the California, that area. But this was in the early days. And Jan and Paul watched me be interviewed by this particular guy, and I get a call from Paul, and I actually got a call from Jan, and she said, "You know, you can do TV. Will you come on and stay another night?" So I went on. Paul and Jan hosted. I was on, and we were a very small organization, and Paul Crouch looked in that camera and said, "Send our David." I was much younger then. Some support. And I mean, we got calls from the post office saying you got to bring a truck to pick up the mail you got.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it was just unreal. And that just led to, and then when Paul talked with Pat, when Pat wanted to form this national organization, Paul called Pat. I mean, it's just, it was the kingdom working together, which is when the kingdom does best. And we get to be some of the fruit of that. So we've been mentored under some of the best in the world, godly leaders, smart guys and gals, and just filled with the Spirit and knew the Lord, know the Lord. And I mean, like I said, you couldn't orchestrate any of this. There is no way you could orchestrate any of this.
Well, we aren't quite as big as CBN by any stretch, but we have somewhere around 10,000 to as many as 80,000 people that watch this broadcast. And Jay, you need to let them know real quickly. We'll make this also available at the end of the program, but you need to let them know your website, how they get in touch with you, because a lot of people are going to want to join in with you.
Yeah. So the website's aclj.org. That's aclj.org. That's a great way to connect with us. We've got emails that go out and newsletters and updates on the cases constantly being updated. And of course, I've got a Twitter feed at Jay Sekulo, and the ACLJ has one at ACLJ. So there's a lot of ways to connect on social media platforms as well. I appreciate that.
And I'd really like to encourage those of you watching. We've been partners with Jay for decades. And I tell you, this is our monthly newsletter right here. Well, and it's a list of all of the things that they got accomplished in 2018 and then all of the things that they're dealing with in 2019. And I tell you, God has really positioned ACLJ to be a major force. And I tell you, I'd shudder to think of what would be happening in our nation if you weren't available, Jay, and doing what you're doing. So thank you very much for everything you're doing. It's awesome.
Thank you, Andrew.
That's great.
And thanks for your partnership all these years.
And, you know, we've got a lot of things we could talk about. We need to get into some of this. But I specifically want to ask you about this Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act. That, you know, I just wrote an email that we are sending out this week to, we have, I think, 450,000 people on our email list that I'm sending this to. And I'm saying that the mask has been taken off. Anybody who thought that abortion was all about the women's rights, this proves that even once the baby is outside of the woman, they are willing to let that baby die. It's infanticide, and I'm in this email, just like you have done, we have listed the people that voted against this, basically voting for murder of born alive children. And so anyway, I'm really incensed about this. I want to get your input on this, and where do you think we're going with this?
You know, the life issue has been something that's been a big part of our organization since the very beginning. I argued a series of pro-life cases before the Supreme Court in the mid-90s, and it's been a big part of what we do. And then you had the situation. I'll tell you what really kind of launched all this, Andrew, over the last couple of months, was this overreach in Virginia, where the sponsor of a particular piece of legislation was two things. It was New York and Virginia. In Virginia, they sponsored this legislation which removed not only all restrictions from protecting the child and just an unrestricted right to abortion, but included after the child was born, where the governor of the state of the Commonwealth of Virginia said, well, we would decide what, once the child was born, then we talk to the parents and decide what they want to do about it. And he says, once the child was born, you've got to protect the child. I mean, you've got to give a medical necessity. You know, what do you mean? You will decide what the parent, what are you going to do? But they said it, and then they realized when they said it, what they had said. And the sponsor of the bill doubled down on that and then ended up rolling it back. And at the same time that that was going on, New York passed this most aggressive abortion law in the country. And at the same time, and this is what's so interesting, while we're fighting for the unborn on that front, You have at the same time New York trying to close crisis pregnancy centers. That is these centers that offer women in a crisis pregnancy hope, the gospel, assistance financially, education, adoption referral, and they were trying to close those organizations down while they were promoting basically infanticide. So yeah. We went to work in our government affairs office. I sent a litigation team to New York to litigate the issues. And we're, of course, we've sent Freedom of Information Act requests out to Virginia to find out what was behind this bill. But it's the same industry. And it's an industry that is committed to, without any apology, committed to standing, in their view, for this unrestricted right to abortion, which, of course, is contrary to the right to life and the protection of the unborn. We've got to start arguing that the unborn child is a person entitled to protection under the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. And, Jay, I'm sure that you can address this much better than what I've done in past broadcasts, but isn't there a provision or something in the Roe versus Wade decision that this was made based on the fact that they couldn't prove when life began? And if you could prove that a child in the womb was a person, then they would be entitled to all of the rights of any other person.
Right. So the underpinning of Roe was this, what they called the penumbras. There was not a right to abortion recognized in the Constitution. They said, well, it emanates out of the Bill of Rights, emanates, comes out of, but no text. And then they said, you know, because that you could, after, and by the way, that was first trimester abortions, which are still horrible, but that's how they viewed it. And then it, what happened was, as does happen with Supreme Court cases, precedent grew upon precedent to where now we won the partial birth abortion cases out of the Supreme Court, but then the abortionists just do a different method. So you're right from a precedent standpoint. But what we have to be clear on is that the right to defending the right to life is going to be an intergenerational issue that my kids and my grandkids will be defending. Yeah. Because the right to life has been under attack before Roe versus Wade, but certainly under Roe. And look, it's changed. It's not just a legal change. It's the hearts and minds of the people.
Yeah. Right.
We have the most aggressive abortion laws in any country in the world.
Yeah.
It's not a good position to be in.
I can probably get by with saying things that you can't because you're dealing in a different arena than what I am. But, you know, I just believe that the wolves in sheep's clothing have lost their sheep's clothing. I mean, this has flushed them out in the open, and they are just absolutely about that woman's convenience, and they are willing to kill a child in order to make it easy on themselves. Yeah. It's basically what it means.
If you look at moments of history on major societal issues, there's always what I call the overreach. Mm-hmm. You pull the sheep's clothing come off. Mm-hmm. And this was one of those moments of overreach. And the reaction from the country was repulsion, that this was even being advocated. And they said it so clinically, like as if it was no big deal. But most Americans find it to be a very big deal.
Yeah, and on your website, you have listed the people that voted against this thing, which I agree 100%. And I have listed their names, and we are going to call this out. And when it comes the next election, I believe that any person who voted to kill a born live baby, a human being, they ought to be kicked out of office.
Well, and we took Jay's article and posted it on our website tonight. So folks can go on our website and find that same list.
Yeah, so we'll have a link to Jay's website on the truthandliberty.net deal. So there's so many other things that you're dealing with, but I think that right now, if I'm not mistaken, ACLJ is also arguing the case about the cross that has come before the Supreme Court.
That one was argued last week, the Brandenburg Cross. Now, that is a World War I memorial. It's been up for 100 years. It was put in by the county in memory of those men that gave their lives in defense of freedom during World War I. It's been there without a problem. And then all of a sudden, the groups that don't like religious freedom, that don't like any symbolism, religious symbolism of our heritage, of our country, and they filed this challenge. The case went to the Supreme Court of the United States. My friends at another great legal group, First Liberty, they represented the American Legion in the case. The county defended the statute, which is unusual. The United States government came in on our side as well. We actually represented a general, a retired U.S. Marine Corps general from the area, and filed a brief with the court, a friend of the court brief. And that case was argued last week. It did not make much news because there was a lot of other news, but it looks like a very good decision coming our way. I've handled a couple of these others. I had a Ten Commandments case in Utah that we won unanimously a couple years back. There's been some other symbolism cases when, you know, like the cross. But if they were right, you would have to then go through Arlington Cemetery and remove every Star of David and cross that it's on all those soldiers' graves. I mean, that's the nature and scope of their argument. But those that are so opposed to even acknowledging the religious heritage, I mean, Justice O'Connor made this famous quote once. She said, it was in the Pledge of Allegiance case where they held the pledge was constitutional, but she said, it would be ironic indeed if a nation founded by religious refugees, talk about the history of our country, would sever the ties that bind it to that heritage even today. And I think that's exactly right. And Justice O'Connor got that right. And I think the Supreme Court will overwhelmingly get that right in just we probably won't get the decision until the end of June.
Well, Jay, you've argued cases like this, you know, about the atheist and people, freedom from religion and all this stuff. And you've been arguing cases like this and winning them. And yet they seem like they just repeat and come at it from a different standpoint. How do you stop this?
Yeah, they come in and they come in waves. I mean, it's like you have a group of cases in the I've had the privilege of arguing for in front of the Supreme Court in the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s. And the last decision came out in 2010. And on the merits. And so I've had a lot. And then we had a whole series of cases on the Obamacare legislation, the mandate for abortion that was in that. And we had two cases at the Supreme Court on that we're successful with. But they come in waves, and then we're just in one of these other waves right now. I mean, this is where it is. And you just got to keep defending. You can't stop. You just go out and do it. You know, it happens. They come up with a new theory and you go after the new theory.
And you were talking about overreach, and I agree with that 100%. I call it the devil always overplays his hand. Mm-hmm. And I just think that now any deception that they have been putting forth about, you know, trying to do something for the women's rights, or you could go into all of these other issues, they always take this verbiage and make it sound like they're doing something good. Trump ran on draining the swamp. I don't know if it's been drained, but the water level has been lowered so that we are seeing.
I think that's a fair way of saying it. I don't know if you can ever drain it.
Yeah, we are seeing their true intent. And so we always try and put something positive on here because there's so much negative news out. How do you feel? Yeah. Are we winning? Has Trump made a difference? Has the momentum changed? What's going on in our nation?
We've got two great Supreme Court justices with Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. I mean, great justices. You got the embassy in Israel has been moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. So the United States recognizes, which is what Israel has always said, that Jerusalem is the eternal capital of Israel. That's happened. I take the case of Andrew Brunson, I mentioned earlier, American, ministering in Turkey for 25 years, never had a problem, gets arrested, thrown in jail. President Trump directly engages for his release. Same thing is true with this pastor Saul, the case we now have in China. And so I think, look, you know, you don't get everything you want in the body politic. That, you know, politics is the art of the possible. But I think the president has delivered what he said he would and has consistently been doing that. He doesn't get everything he wants. That's just the way it is. Elections have consequences. The House is now controlled by the other party. You got to deal with that. And that's what we're, you know, that's just the nature of it. So you can't lose heart, though. You just got to keep, I tell this all the time. You just got to keep each day, just move forward. You can't plan the next 20 years out. You can't plan the next 20 minutes out, in a sense, in my life these days. You just got to handle it as it comes and just keep dealing with it. Keep your head up. Know that God's in control of the universe. God's in control of your life. The Lord is sovereign, and that gets you through it.
And, Jay, I'd also like you. Did you have something?
Well, I was going to just mention we've got folks on here from all over the world tonight and all over America. We've got people from Hong Kong, Australia, Canada, the Philippines. Man, looks like at least half the United States, Arizona, Florida, Pennsylvania, Oklahoma, Missouri, North Carolina, Colorado, California. So that's amazing. Awesome, awesome viewers. And I thought also, Andrew, I would point out that we've uploaded onto our website another important article of Jay's, and it's the legal analysis that you did on whether Donald Trump has the authority under the law to declare a national emergency that will enable him to build the border wall. So,
I'd like to hear Jay's opinion on that.
Well, we've got some great articles on the website, so folks can check that out. And just wanted to mention that so people could get in there.
I'm going to on that issue. I'm the grandson of a Russian immigrant. I'm a grandson of immigrants. So I'm just a second generation of my family born in the United States. So I believe in immigration, and I think that there is a lot of great, I mean, this country is great because we are literally the melting pot. But my grandparents came in legally. They went through Ellis Island, took my grandfather 14 years to get his citizenship. He did get it, and here we are. So the president's concerned about what's going on our southern border, which is serious. He has the authority under the National Emergency Act to take action. He did. And after Congress, trying to get it worked through Congress, couldn't get it done, he did. So now it's going to be challenged, which it will. They're going to fail in the House. They're not going to be able to. If they passed it, in the House it passed, but didn't pass by a veto-proof majority. So they're legislatively not going to be able to undo what the president did, but they're going to go to court. They already are. And it's going to go to the Ninth Circuit, which is where these go, and then ultimately goes to the Supreme Court, and we prevail at the Supreme Court. And the president's trying. Look, I mean, here's something that people ignore about the southern the border. It's not the drug issue is significant. It's not just people coming over that aren't supposed to be here. It's the sex trafficking that is a huge deal. Mm-hmm. And that in and of itself should be reason to put security in place, because if you can stop the access, that stops the industry.
Well, for me, you don't have to look any further than just the fact that it's the law. We ought to enforce the law. Yeah. When you aren't enforcing your laws, what do you have if you don't enforce your laws?
I think the real national emergency might be that we have a Congress that won't do what it needs to do.
Well, it's been this way for a long
time. But it is bad.
Well, that's part of it.
The article that Jay has some great stats in it on the crisis at the border and, you know, the Mexican gangs, the sex trafficking and all that sort of thing. So I encourage people to check that out.
And Jay, let me say that for the last 2 or 3 years, I've been doing kind of a crash course getting involved in not politics, but getting in, well, I don't know what you call it, politics, but I'm getting involved in social issues, and we're taking a stand, and we've got a practical government school in our Bible college. But anyway, some of the things that I've been learning are that there's many Christians that feel once it becomes the law of the land, well, then they feel like, well, then there's nothing you can do about it. But I've been studying, and I've learned about like the Dred Scott case. That was a Supreme Court decision.
Right.
They passed civil rights legislation in the 1870s, I believe it was, or late 60s, right after the Civil War. And yet the Supreme Court in the 1870s or 80 just overruled it and stopped all the civil rights thing.
Yeah.
So anyway, my point to you is you're an expert on this, but just because the Supreme Court has done it, we've got a history of Supreme Court making decisions that have been wrong and we've been able to overturn it. How do we deal with all of this?
Well, look, I mean, Dred Scott's a perfect example. Plessy versus Ferguson, another one, you know, separate but equal. So ultimately, the Supreme Court can correct itself. So what you have to do when you have a bad precedent is try to get that precedent changed. It's true you have to respect the law of the land while it's the law of the land, but there's nothing in the Constitution. In fact, to the contrary, the Constitution says you can challenge laws. Marbury versus Madison, the Supreme Court case written by the great Chief Justice John Marshall, said that the Supreme Court reviews the statutes to determine their constitutionality. And ultimately, the Supreme Court got the fixed Plessy versus Ferguson, fixed Dred Scott, but it took 100 years. Hmm. So perseverance here is the key. And as I say, on the life issue, you know, Roe versus Wade is a 1973 opinion. It's been around a long time. And it's just, you know, you just got to keep chipping away and trying to get there. You can't lose hope. You just got to keep fighting back. And that's exactly right. I mean, that you can laws can change.
I believe that one of the things that has caused this resurgence, or they've coming out in the open with abortion and things like this, is because they see the Supreme Court changing with Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, mm-hmm. and I believe that they're running scared and that they have taken away all semblance of trying to make it about women's rights and stuff. They're desperate.
I think that's right.
Yeah. And so let me ask you this. Kavanaugh, I just read that Kavanaugh had voted with some of the liberal judges on a decision recently. How do you think that Kavanaugh is stacking up? Do you think mm-hmm. that the direction of the court has changed?
Look, I think that it's a more conservative court than it was a year ago. And mm-hmm. what you have to understand is some of these cases where they utilize the conservative liberal issue, it can also be an issue of jurisdiction. It could be an issue of we're not going to go there yet. For instance, the Chief Justice, John Roberts, denied a stay in a case that was coming up on a pro-life issue. Mm-hmm. He had previously, the year before, ruled in favor of the pro-life position. Now, he voted to not hear the case on an emergency stay, not because he thinks that the decision was right, but rather because jurisdictionally it wasn't present. So I think, look, you never know where justice is going to be until they start writing their opinions. But these are two nominees that have conservative jurisprudence in their history. And I'm confident that they will be conservative justices. Doesn't mean you get them on every case, though. And you shouldn't pretend that you will. You won't.
And could you also address this, that we know that the Supreme Court is important, but the vast majority of litigation is handled in the appeals court stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think
the Supreme Court,
Trump has been appointing a lot of conservative people for that.
Yes, because the Supreme Court only hears about 75 cases a year. And there's thousands of cases decided by the courts of appeals. So most cases are decided at the Court of Appeals. I mean, that's just fact. The Court of Appeals is where most cases are decided.
So I know that Trump has been appointing a lot of conservative appeals court judges. Yep. Where do we stand? I mean, how many would it take to see, like, the Ninth Circuit that is always liberal?
The Ninth Circuit's a tough one, Andrew. There's that's a tough one. The joke is, if you have won a case in the Ninth Circuit, prepare to lose it at the Supreme Court. That's just kind of generally how it goes.
Yep.
And the Ninth Circuit's going to be tough. That's going to be tough because what's called the blue slip rule, where the senators have a say in who the nominees are and you got to negotiate. But I think you're going to see a more conservative judiciary already. You've seen it. And you're going to see more of that in 2 years. And if there's a reelection of the president, you'll see more of that in 6 years total. So it doesn't change overnight. But the trend is, and they know it, are conservative judges. And that means ultimately conservative decisions.
Now, didn't Trump just appoint a replacement for Kavanaugh and he ignored that blue slip rule and he got a lot of criticism over that?
That was out of the D.C. That's a D.C. Circuit nomination. It has not been confirmed yet, but probably will be.
And so he basically went around that blue slip thing. Is this something that is
not
obligated?
A blue slip is not a law. It's more of a practice.
Okay.
So it's part of a negotiation that the White House counsel has to do.
I thought I had read a couple of years ago that Mitch McConnell and maybe it was Grassley, chairman of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, has suspended the blue slip rule. Do you know if that's still the case or?
Well, it's a question of, it's not just whether it's suspended, it's what's the actual practice.
Yeah.
So to get it out of these committees, and that's where the Senate is a collegial body, and that's where this happens, and that's what you see develop. So even if it's not the law per se, that doesn't mean that there's not the backroom side of it. But look, I mean, the White House counsel's job under the president's direction is to negotiate those things. That's not what his outside lawyers do, but they're doing a very good job of getting judicial confirmations through.
Well, Jay, I really believe that we are in a cultural war. I mean, this is just as severe as the Civil War or any war that we've ever faced, but it's basically being fought in the legal system. That's how these liberals and progressive have been able to make the gains that they have. The vast majority of American public is not for the things they're pushing, but they have got judicial people to push it through. So I just really praise God that God has raised you up and other people to be able to do this, because the church has been praying. But I tell you, we got to do more than just pray. We got to get out and do something. And I see you on the front lines and praise God for everything you're doing.
Absolutely.
It's awesome.
I appreciate that.
And so give us your website again, how they get in touch with you. And I would like to encourage people, Jamie and I support ACLJ, and I'd like to encourage you to do it. Because do you have any idea, I'm sure you do, how many people you have with you now? You said when you started it was just you and your wife.
We have a table. We started the ministry on a table, an oak table in our kitchen. I have that oak table in my office right now. I keep
it.
We had it redone, so it looks better than it used to look. But we still have it because I tell everybody that's where it started, right there on that table. Our newsletter, Andrew, back in the late 80s, was written by hand and then photocopied.
Yeah.
My wife was a school teacher, so she has great penmanship. Pen would write it, and then out it would go. And
that's great.
And now that we've got hundreds of thousands of members around the country and around the world, and you all have been faithful partners, that's what makes the difference for any organization. And you all have been that's why I was so delighted to come on with you tonight. You all have been so great to us. I can't even return the favor, but I appreciate it so much. It means the world. And I'll tell you what means the most. I get stopped every day, multiple times a day. I get text messages from people I haven't seen in 10 years saying they're praying for us. I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. You know, God has been very gracious, and I know people are praying, and it makes a big difference. When we feel like, you know, you're bucking against all the wind against you, and you know the Lord's at your back, it's a pretty good feeling,
Amen.
As you know.
That's awesome. We've got some questions coming in.
Okay. Let me just say one last thing that, you know, this last week we came into a little financial difficulty, and for the first time in probably 20 years, I sent out an email that said, we need help right now. Usually my appeals are about, we're doing this, God is doing this, join with us, and it's real positive. But I had to put out kind of a desperation thing. And to the point that you were making, Jay, I was so blessed to see, it's only been 2 days, and our partners have responded tremendously. And that's so awesome, just like what you're saying, Jay, I know that, man, these partners are our lifeline. We couldn't do what we're doing without them.
That's awesome.
So I encourage people to get in and support ACLJ. Tell them once again how they can become a part of what you're doing.
Best way, ACLJ.org. You can join the organization right online. And I want to pick up on something you just said. The truth, I said this today, is we're dealing with this case in China for this pastor. He's an American, permanent American resident, a permanent resident in the United States. Family's all American. He's been ministering in China and the United States for 3 decades, and has been in jail for 2 years. And I told our partners that, you know, we can talk about these cases, but we get to do them because of their support. And you are so right with, I mean, I don't take it for granted for a moment, people standing with us and our teams. And I know exactly what you feel like a couple of weeks ago. We've all had those moments in ministry. It's just kind of the way it is. But God has, you know, pours it out. And you got to realize it's coming from the Lord. He uses people, but it's the Lord that puts this on the burden on people's hearts.
Amen. Yeah. Well, we got some questions here, so you got a question for him, Richard?
Yeah, we have a lot of questions coming in. One of them here is on the topic of the Johnson Amendment, Jay, which we get a lot of questions about that. And guest number 8287 on chat asks, have any churches landed in trouble for violating the Johnson Amendment? And if by changing or registering under a new name, can that church get out of the Johnson Amendment?
So the president issued an executive order that the Johnson Amendment was not going to be enforced. He can't change the law, but he could stop enforcement. So you don't really see much enforcement of the law, but the law needs to be changed. Now, in this House, it's not going to happen. I think the Johnson Amendment, by the way, let me say what that is. It was put in the 1960s, and it said 501c3s, which would include churches, cannot mention politics from the pulpit. And the difficulty with that is, with all the contemporary issues that are going on, how do you not? And I think it's a complete restriction on free speech. I think litigated, we would win it today. But it's not being enforced right now, but it's still the law. I mean, the law is still there, but it's not being enforced like it was.
And it completely violates our history. I mean, the churches are the ones that made this nation.
It started the revolution.
Absolutely.
The pulpits were flamed. Yeah, I mean, they were on fire for liberty. Right.
The Black Robe Regiment and all of that. Yep. Well, what impact do you think the Johnson Amendment has had just on the mentality of pastors and preachers in this country over the last 50 years? A lot of people, say that it's really dampened our influence on government and other parts of society as well.
You know, in the law, they say it chills free speech, and that's exactly right. I mean, pastors are afraid to address issues because there's, you know, nobody wants to get their tax-exempt status in jeopardy, which is, I understand it. But the fact is that curtails the ability of the pastor to minister according to the dictates of his or her conscience. And I think that's when we're in a danger zone. So while I'm optimistic that we would carry the day legally and it's not being enforced, it's still on the books. And we had a couple opportunities to get rid of it, but it just never quite got over the threshold. But again, a complete, in my view, a violation of freedom of speech.
And so an executive order basically means that the next administration could come in and totally undo it.
In a minute.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Correct. In 1 minute.
Here's a question. It looks like it's from Brenda on Facebook. And this says, why isn't Islam treated with the same scrutiny and adverse reaction as a religion as Christianity is? It seems it has been given way too much leeway and infiltrating into almost every area. So
we had a series of cases in California on this issue where they were studying Islam as a religion. Well, that's fine. In a comparative religion course in high school, they should be doing that. I think you need to understand all the religions of the world. But here they had the students were required to adopt a Muslim name, bow towards Mecca, kind of engage in Islamic practice. Now, could you imagine if a teacher was going to teach on Christianity and said, okay, everybody is going to say the Lord's Prayer and it's going to talk about Jesus as the King Messiah. Can you imagine the reaction? But it was Islam, and it was like everybody said, oh, you can't say that. Yeah. Now, the good news is we went to work on that and won. But it still exists today, this kind of, it's the political correctness that's really just run amok here. And you saw it in that case, without question.
And, Jay, let me just say, I can say things again that you can't say because of your position, but I think that all political correctness is a spirit of Antichrist. It's not a spirit of anti-Muhammad or mm-hmm. anti-Buddha. Matter of fact, in this newsletter, you were talking here about you're litigating a case or you're dealing with something where they're trying to make Buddhism taught in public schools. Mm-hmm. And so there's not that rejection against those things. It's Christianity. It is a demonic force. And you may not be able to say that in your position, but I'm going to call it out that this is a spirit of Antichrist, and it is a spiritual battle that we're involved in.
Well, they call the curriculum was called mindfulness, and it was, and they acknowledged it was Buddhist principles and Buddhist teaching. But they said, well, you can't call it that because it would create all kind of church-state issues. But again, this is kind of like you said. Can you imagine if they said we're all going to start the beginning of the school day with the Lord's Prayer, what the reaction would be? And this, I'll let you speak to the way you spoke as the pastor. I'll just do it as the lawyer and saying it violates the Constitution.
Well, I don't want to pull you into an arena that'll get you in trouble. But
I'm not. This is a free country. You can certainly speak your mind, and you did.
So the Antichrist is in violation of the Constitution. That's the bottom line. We have another question, which has to do with the rise of anti-Semitism, or the apparent rise of anti-Semitism, and we've been posting on our website some of these news articles, but, you know, from Jewish cemeteries being desecrated in France to attacks on Jewish people in Brooklyn, New York, and this Representative Omar in the U.S. Congress and so forth. I was just curious, are you seeing this as an increase as well, and what thoughts do you have about that?
Look, this is as I told you, I'm a Jew who believes in Jesus, so I have the Jewish heritage, and that those desecrations in France, exactly where our office is located in Strasbourg, France. So, I'm taking this very personally. And Representative Omar's disgusting statements are exactly that, are outrageous. But anti-Semitism is in vogue. And we have and there's this movement around the world called BDS, Boycott, Divest, and Sanction Israel. They'll say, well, it's not against Jews, it's just against Israel. And we have a project inside the American Center for Law and Justice, and it works in conjunction with our offices in Jerusalem, New York, Strasbourg, work in Geneva, where we are fighting this boycott, divest, and sanction movement. And we've had cases in court over it. And again, it's this movement that's going on where it's to delegitimize the Jewish state, but also this increase of anti-Semitism. And I think this is at an epidemic proportion. And I think there's supposed to be a vote on Wednesday in the House on Representative Omar's statement, because even her Democratic colleagues are saying that this stuff is repulsive. But this is what they're promulgating. This is what they're practicing. This is what they're saying. And it's a vile form. There's no such thing as a good form of anti-Semitism. But this is really a vile and disgusting attack on the Jewish people. And we, as someone who's Jewish and also a Christian, but we can't tolerate that in our society. And free speech is free speech. But to target people because of who they are is a pretty bad thing.
Jay, let me ask you this question. This is from your partner letter that we just got. It says you're battling UN's treacherous 65 million anti-Israel lawfare slush fund. And then you also said that they are trying to destroy Israel through litigation. What is all of this about?
Yeah, so they have $65 million in a budget in the United Nations that basically its job is delegitimize the state of Israel. And they engage in, we know what warfare is. I call it lawfare. They're utilizing the legal system to try to delegitimize Israel as a nation state. I mean, where else in the Middle East can you practice any religion you want to practice? Mm-hmm. Israel. That's it in the region. Yeah. No place else. And who has rights on the most liberal democratic, and I use this in the right way, views on independent freedom and individual liberty? Israel. Yet who is targeted the most by the United Nations? Israel. More targeting on Israel than on Syria. I mean, this is what's so outrageous. But it's called lawfare, and I've litigated these cases. Mm-hmm. I continue to litigate these cases. A big part of what we do at the ACLJ is standing against this. And look, it's a real fight. And I don't want to tell you for a moment it's not. It's a real fight.
Thank you again for doing it, man. We appreciate you being out there doing this.
Yeah, on the front lines.
We got another question?
Yeah.
We're drawing to a close here. Got 8 minutes and 45 seconds.
This one kind of goes back to the immigration issue again, and I think this is something a lot of people have wondered over the last 2 years, and this is coming from Sandy on Facebook, and the question is, why are sanctuary cities allowed to continue? I think the average person wonders, how can that be? How can a state, you know, declare they're not going to enforce federal immigration law?
This is it's a great issue because on immigration, the federal government, the Supreme Court has said, is the law supreme. But various cities and some states have said, we're sanctuary states. We're not going to prosecute this. Well, this hurts everybody else. There's been litigation back and forth on it, and it's not clear where the courts will ultimately come. But the law is that the federal government sets policies on naturalization, immigration, and border access. That's a federal government role, not a state. But these states, it's not that many, but a few of them have challenged this. And it's created these, but I've seen these sanctuary cities where they won't enforce laws against people that are not here legally that engage in criminal conduct.
Yeah. Well, we've actually got an ACLU lawsuit against our sheriff's office right here in Woodland Park because they are cooperating with ISIS. I mean, not ICE, excuse me.
ICE.
And they are cooperating, and the ACLU sued them over it.
I think he won at the district court.
Yeah, no, I know that. I've been following that case. Yep.
That's great.
So switching gears for a second, President Trump just conducted a very brief meeting with Kim Jong-un of North Korea. And, you know, the liberal media was characterizing that summit as a failure because of how short it was. But, you know, at least through my eyes, I look at it as Trump, the negotiator. When the demands are unreasonable, he left that guy hanging in the wind saying we're not going to play those games. But I don't know what your take might be on that. And what does that situation look like from your perspective?
I think as long as you're talking to your enemy, it's better than being in war.
Absolutely. That's a great answer.
Negotiate with your enemy, it's better than being at war. Now, this is a president that's not afraid to walk away from a bad deal. And the deal that they put on the table was not a deal that was a good deal for the United States. So he said no. Does that mean that they're not going to talk again? No, I think that there'll be ongoing discussions. But the president made a decision. He flew around the world to meet with Kim Jong-un, first president to do this now for the second time. And although it did not end, as I think a lot of us would have liked to have seen, including the president, this is part of how you have to negotiate in the world we live in. And the world's safer for the fact that the president met with Kim Jong-un, because in the interim, there had been no missiles launched, no missiles over Japan, no missiles into the Sea of Japan. And you had historic moments, even though it isn't where you want it to be yet, where the leader of North Korea stepped over the DMZ line into South Korea. And who would have thought that would have been possible?
Yeah, right.
So it's called confidence building measures in diplomatic talk. And they didn't get what they wanted. The White House did not get what they wanted. The president did not get what he wanted. But that doesn't mean you don't keep trying, and he will. I don't know if that means there'll be another summit before the next election, but at least there's discussions still go on.
Right.
Very good.
Yeah.
Jay, let me ask you a question. This may be personal. If it is, you can tell me no. That's fine. I don't mind you telling me.
All right.
I am admiring Trump because he is taking heat and criticism like nobody I've ever seen. And I don't know anybody else that could have stood up to it. Because of your personal relationship with him, do you have a feel on how this affects him? He acts like he actually enjoys the fight.
Well, he's not one to shy away from a fight, I can tell you that. Look, he compartmentalizes well. I mean, I think if you're going to be president of the United States, you got to realize you're going to have incoming. He gets a lot of it. And he compartmentalizes it. And then, you know, you've got people around you that you trust, both inside of government and outside of government, that advise. I read every book by every lawyer that served every president of the United States since Harry Truman.
Wow.
To get a kind of sense it's like to represent a president. And if you look at it historically, Andrew, what you find is they're different personalities, but it's a lot of the same stuff. Now, we got a lot of incoming this last couple of weeks. There'll be more in the next couple of weeks. But, you know, you deal with it. What I always say is one day at a time. You deal with what you got today. You go to sleep at night. You wake up in the morning, put your boots back on, and go back to work.
Yeah.
And that's what you have to do. And the president's very good at doing that. And I think the country, it shows in the country. And the country's deeply divided. It's very possible. And this is nothing against Bernie Sanders personally, but it's very possible that Bernie Sanders is going to be the nominee for the Democratic Party, who says he's a socialist, doesn't apologize. Uh-huh. That would be a stark contrast to what our founding fathers envisioned for our country.
Absolutely.
Let me just say it that way. But it's a free country. He's entitled to run. And if he wins, he's entitled to win. I think the president would win overwhelmingly. But this is the nature of the body politic. We live in a constitutional republic where elections have consequences.
You know, it's not always clear, the choices. Sometimes it's lesser of two evils. But, I mean, everything is dividing. So that it is very clear.
I'm shocked
that we had the Democrats win back the House the way that they did in this last election. Because, man, for anybody who was paying attention, they should have been able to foresee what this would cause. But it's a shame. If we got time for one more question.
Thank you,
Richard.
Yeah. I had a question for you, Jay, and it seems like here in Colorado we're fighting some real battles with the Democrats, and somebody recently said, you know, that they're overreaching, and we may need to send them all a Christmas card because of how far they're overreaching. And I wonder if that's true on the national level, too, with this socialism that's rolling out. The new Green Deal and Medicare for All, I was just looking today at some price tags on those. And
it's unreal.
The Medicare for All price tag by one study pegs it at 60 trillion or something like that, 30 trillion,
and $60 trillion.
The Green Deal, $90 trillion over 10 years.
Right.
Staggering.
The country's bankrupt.
One thing said that we couldn't, even if we doubled our income tax rates, we couldn't pay for the Medicare for
all. What's our gross domestic product per year?
$14-16 trillion.
Yeah,
or something
like
that.
I mean, this is years and years and years worth of our total income.
Yeah, it's
GDP.
Incredible.
It's just impossible.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
It tells you. Yeah, it tells you the nature of the fight you're in. I mean, I think it's going to be really a clash of two worldviews coming up in the next election. I mean, we're already getting into that cycle. And it's going to be a clash of worldviews as it relates to how do we view ourselves as a constitutional republic? We believe in liberty, democracy, freedom, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom of religion, of course. And then you have a socialist worldview that is much more state-controlled. That's the whole idea with socialism. And my grandparents fled Russia when it became a communist country. It had been socialist. It's a similar ideology.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Some people say socialism is not much different than Marxism, except it allows for a vote. I'm not going to get into the merits of that one way or another. I will just say that we're a constitutional republic. Thomas Jefferson was asked after the signing of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, and they were in Philadelphia, and the Constitution had been put forward, and it was very interesting that he was asked, a woman came up to him and said, Dr. Franklin, what do we have? And he said to her, we have a republic, madam, if you can keep it.
Yeah, I've heard
and
that.
And that's what we are. We're a constitutional republic if we can keep it.
Jay, we got less than a minute left, but I just want to say it's been an honor. I know you were really busy. You had to come in just at the last minute. Thank you for giving
us
this time.
Thank you.
And again, I'd like to encourage all of the people viewing to go to the ACLJ website and become a partner. My wife and I have been doing it, and I think it's on the front lines, and you would be blessed. So, Jay, once again, thank you so much for being with us. Man, we support you, and we're glad for all of you watching. And we pray that you will get involved. We've got to get off of our knees, which we don't quit praying, but we've got to pray and then act. Faith without works is dead, and we've got to get involved. And I tell you, I believe that this litigation is where the war is being fought today. So thank you for being with us. God bless you. We'll see
you
again next week on Monday night, Truth and Liberty broadcast.
Join us next time for the Truth and Liberty broadcast. Find tonight's episode and related articles and links at truthandliberty.net.